WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
To continue our Miles Davis birthday commemoration, we're going to showcase a new public radio program. We have an excerpt of This American Life, hosted and produced by Ira Glass at WBEZ in Chicago. Ira is probably best known to NPR listeners from his series of reports on All Things Considered, in which he followed students at Chicago's Taft High School and Washington Irving Elementary School. He also produces the morning edition commentaries by David Sedaris, including the story of working as one of Santa's elves in Macy's department store at Christmas. This American Life has been a popular show on WBEZ in Chicago for several months. Listeners outside of Chicago will have a chance to hear it beginning in June when the program goes national. It features monologues, documentaries, and original works for radio. We think it's an exciting program because it's finding original and absorbing ways of telling personal stories on the radio. Each week, Ira explores a different theme: immigrant parents, the drama bug, people who live secret double lives, chickens and turkeys, or hero worship. And that's what brings us to Miles Davis.
Here's a question we had. What if you idolize someone from afar, and then somehow, over the course of your life, you manage to actually get close to them? You know, actually become their friend. What happens to the romantic dream that you had of them? Well, this is what happened to writer Quincy Troop with Miles Davis. Troop first heard of Miles Davis back when Troop was just a teenager in East St. Louis. And one of the things that was appealing about Miles Davis was the fact that he also was from East St. Louis and had managed to get out, escaped to New York City. Troop, when he first heard Davis's music, was going to a nearly all-white high school. And as he'll be the first to tell you, he was looking for a way to be hip.
I was in a fish fry place, and I saw these four black guys sitting in this booth eating Jack Salmon sandwiches and dinners with dark glasses on and hats, and their hair was conked and everything. So I thought they looked pretty hip. So I went and got my sandwich and sat behind them. And at that time, they were talking about this homeboy from East St. Louis, and he was in New York City, and he was doing all these great things and playing all this great music, and had played with Charlie Parker, who I didn't know any of this. And they said, Miles Dewey Davis, Miles Davis, you know, his name is Miles Davis. And they went up to the record player and put in some money and played Donna Lee. And I remember listening to Donna Lee, and I said, wow, I hadn't liked jazz up until that point. I was about 14 to 15 years old. You know, I was into Johnny Ace and Chuck Berry and, I mean, that kind of music, rhythm and blues. And when I heard this music, for some reason, they played it twice. And the second time, it kind of went straight to my heart. I don't know, I can't explain why it went straight to my heart, but I kind of loved the music. And I sat there, and they sat there for about an hour, and then they left. And when they left, I remember going up to the record player, and I had about 30 cents or something. It was a nickel to play those records. And I went up there and flipped through all those names and found Miles Davis's name and played Donna Lee. And I played Donna Lee, then I played another one. That's when I first heard Miles Davis, and then after that, my cousin told me how hip he was and showed me pictures of him and how clean he was. I started seeing how well he dressed and what great style he had.
How clean he was.
Yeah. You know, we used to say he was clean as a broke dick dog, you know, which was a saying that came out of St. Louis, you know. And so I said, wow, this is a guy that I really love. So I started really listening to his music at that time, and it kind of changed my life. And then I found some other friends who had been listening to him for a while, and I kind of left my other friends and started listening to Miles and hanging out with them. And we used to sit up in the stands at Sumner High School and say we were going to run away to New York and be like Miles Davis. So I remember the first time he came to St. Louis, and it was all this big buzz about him coming to play there. And I doctored up my draft card and changed all the dates and everything so I could be old enough to get into the club. And I remember going to the pawn shop and getting these great suits and these these church's shoes, which were too small for my feet. You know, they were those really hip English shoes, and I had these big Chesterfield hats, and I was really clean. So, but my feet hurt. My feet hurt because the shoes were too small. The shoes are too small. So I go to Peacock Alley with some friends of mine, and we get in. The guy looked at me and said, "Are you really?" Because I was really young looking, but he let me in finally. Just let me in. And when that band hit, they were so fantastic. They were so fantastic. Miles was so clean. He was so clean and so hip that I was just mesmerized. And so I told my cousin who went with us that I wanted to go up and say hello to Miles and tell him how much I loved his music. And so my cousin said, "Quincy, don't go up and say nothing to Miles because Miles doesn't talk to people. He doesn't like people to come up to him and talk to him. So don't go up to him and say anything. Just kind of look at him from a distance." So we kind of stood back and looked at him from a distance. All of us, it was a whole bunch of us, young guys and older guys. We had our glasses and everything on like he had his glasses on. And we kind of looked at him standing at the bar smoking a cigarette, drinking a cognac. And from behind us someplace, I heard this voice said, "Oh, darling, there's Miles Davis." And I turned around and it was this white guy with his girlfriend. And I said, "Wow, what is he going to do?" He said, "Let's go up and say hello." So he walked through us. Excuse me. And he walked up to Miles Davis, who was standing at the bar with Coltrane and all of people. He said, "Hi, Miles. How are you?" And Miles said in that gruff voice, "F you. Get out of my face." Like that. And I was like, wow. That was stunning. You know what I mean? I had never heard anybody talk to anyone like that, let alone an African-American man say that to a white guy. You know, and I just said to myself, man, this is something.
Now, when was the first time you met Miles as an adult, kind of as the person who you are now?
Yes, I was living in New York, and my friend, Leo Maitland, who is now deceased, was a doctor. And he was Miles' doctor. And he used to always say to me, "You know, I know Miles Davis." I said, "You got to introduce me to Miles. You got to introduce me to Miles." So one day he said, "I'm going to have this party." And I said, "Okay, you want to come?" I said, "Yeah." So I go to the party. And I walk in and I'm sitting around and near this great apartment. And I look over in the corner and there's Miles Davis. I said, "My God, Miles Davis." And it was nobody sitting next to him. His was the only seat in the house with nobody sitting next to him. So I went and got some food, and I looked around, no place to sit, and went into another room, no place to sit. I came back, there was this seat. So I said, I went and sat next to Miles. So I remember him saying something like, "How you doing?" I said, "Hi, all right." "Yeah, you sure?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "You see anything good in here?" I said, "What?" "Anything, man. I'm talking about, do you see anything good?" And I said, "There's some nice ladies in there." "That's right. That's right, you got a good eye." So I said, "Yeah, I love your music." "I don't want to talk about my music. I don't want to talk about it." I said, "Okay." So then we had this general conversation. And then he went and got some food, came back, said to me, "Later." And he left. So about 2 weeks later, I was walking down.
Wait, can we just hold on that part of the conversation?
Sure.
Was this a kind of nervous moment for you? I mean, you're sitting there next to Miles Davis. What was your feeling during this conversation?
I was totally up for it. I had no fear in talking to him. I guess maybe because I was, by this time, I was starting to get a little play myself as a writer in New York, you know. I was starting to get some ink, and I had a kind of feeling about myself at that point. And so it was funny. We just kind of had this exchange, you know. And then when he got ready to leave, he just left, you know. He just left, but he came over to me and said, "Later." So I thought it was some kind of indication of that he was, you know, he liked the conversation or whatever. And so about 3 weeks later, I was walking down Broadway. And here he comes walking straight towards me. And I said, "Oh, that's Miles Davis." So when he got up next to me, I said, "Hey, Miles, how you doing?" He walked right by me, like I didn't even exist. Like I wasn't even on the planet, you know? I mean, he didn't even nod or nothing. He just walked right by me. And I stopped. I remember stopping, and I kind of looked back and said, "Wow, was that Miles Davis?" And it was. I said, "Yeah, that's him." But he didn't speak. I said, "Hey, Miles," and he didn't even turn around. You know, he just kept going. So I said, "Wow, that was kind of cold." You know? I mean, that was kind of cold. It was like I had never experienced that before in my life. And so when I got to know him, you know, I finally got to know him real well when I did the Spin magazine. I did a two-part piece for Spin magazine. And when I walked in his place, he looked at me and he kind of said, "Yeah, sit down." So I sit down and I remember him reaching out with his hand to grab my dreadlocks. And I hit his hand. Pow! And He said, what are you, crazy? What are you, crazy, hit me like that? I said, no, man. I said, you know, because I'm over here to interview you doesn't mean that you have the right to invade my space. I said, plus the other times that I tried to talk to you, you just shined me on. He said, oh, you mean the time out on the street? The time out on the street? I said, yeah. He said, man, I don't have to talk to you, man. I didn't have to talk to you. What you got to talk about this time? And that's the way it started. And we got to be the best of friends, I mean, until he died. I mean, you know, but it was, you know, Miles was always testing you. He was always testing you. He was the kind of guy, I loved him because he was always the kind of guy that was always testing you. And if you passed the muster, if you could stand up to him, and then if he liked you, he would bring you in. If you couldn't, he'd just run over you, you know?
Quincy Troupe is Miles Davis's biographer. We'll hear more of Troupe's interview with Ira Glass after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Ira Glass's interview with Quincy Troupe. This is an excerpt of Ira's new public radio program, This American Life.
Quincy Troupe spent 3 years collaborating with Miles Davis on Davis's autobiography, talking to Davis and interviewing him actually until Davis got sick of being interviewed, to create a book written in Miles's voice and syntax. It sold over 1 million copies. And if you ask Quincy, when did he stop seeing Miles Davis as the mythic, legendary figure and start seeing him as just another friend, he really can't tell you. It was gradual. One day he was on the outside of Miles' life, looking in, and then at some point later he realized that he was on the inside.
You know, I got very up close with Miles. I was in his pocket and he was in my pocket for like 2.5, 3 years. I mean, until the time he died. I mean, I was really close to him. And so I saw, you know, flaws in his personality that, you know, because I think when you idolize a person like him, like he was one of my heroes, especially when you're young, you don't think they have flaws. You kind of see them through these rose-tinted glasses, and you kind of look at them as perfect. And so when I started to see some things that was not perfect about Miles, like his way of treating women and his way of treating other people sometimes, and little small things, you know, like cleanliness sometimes.
You know, cleanliness is coming up in this interview a lot more than I ever would have guessed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Miles was a clean person. I mean, in terms of like his body and the way he dressed. But, well, there were a couple of times when I went over his house one day and it was a mess. I mean, stuff was everywhere. Clothes, you know, toothbrush, toothpaste, you know, music, trumpets. And I said, Miles. I said, you're living like a pig, man. I said, you're living like a pig, man. This is a pigsty. He said, So what? So what is a pigsty? What you expect? I just play music, chump. He said, somebody cleans it up. That's the deal. When I would see some of that, and first I would say, man, this guy could be a pig, you know. But then I got to the point where I said, no, he's just a human being. He's a human being. He has flaws. He plays beautiful music. But he had these little areas where, you know, he was just a human being, where he was flawed. Like, I never thought Miles would be as country as he was. You know, what I mean by country, I mean country, like a southern, you know, instead of a jazz musician, when you got to know Miles, like some elegant jazz musician, you know, Miles was like a country blues singer.
When was it that you first saw that side of him really clearly?
When I was doing the book and I was about 3 or 4 months in, when he started dropping the mask, you know, and he just dropped the mask and I'd come by and he'd have food and, you know, he'd cook for me and we'd look at boxing matches and look at the basketball games. And at first, when I would go over there, he would always be dressed elegantly, you know, and very fashionable stuff. And then after that, he started dressing just really casually, and especially on the West Coast. When I'd go up there, he'd have on blue jeans, a torn sweater, you know, and he would just cook, and we'd just sit there and look and tell lies, and he'd listen to the fights, and we'd go for long walks on the beach, and he'd take me for rides in his car. So it was just a beautiful kind of relationship. As a matter of fact, I told him, I said, you know, when you're in California, you're much different than you are in New York. And he said, yeah. After a while, he acknowledged that. He said, yeah, because in New York, I got to keep my mask up. I said, yeah, that's right. You got to keep it up.
When did you first figure out about the way he was treating women? When did you first figure out that he was kind of abusive?
Well, when I started to hear some of the stories, because, you know, Miles was brutally honest. He was brutally honest when he did that book. He told me, I remember he was telling me the stories of him beating up these women and chasing his wife around the basement of their house and you know, with a knife and a gun. And, you know, so I started to think to myself, wow, this is ouch, you know. I mean, this is a strange kind of situation because I'm just the opposite. I don't believe in hitting women. You know, I don't believe in hitting anybody, you know, like that. But I figured out that Miles Davis was the kind of person, he wasn't an intellectual where he could respond and talk it out, you know, talk the whole thing through. So if you got up in his faith, whether you were a man or a woman, you know, he would hit you. That was the way he was, you know. I mean, he would hit you. I can be truthful and say I didn't like the way he did certain things, you know. But then at the same time, we who knew him really well knew that he was a warm and generous person to us, you know. And we'd look at those things and say, hey, man, that was kind of cold what he did there. But, you know, I mean, the way I looked at it, I'd say, well, you know, that's between him and that person, you know. I never saw him hit a woman in front of me. Because you got to remember, I knew him from 1985 until he died, which was a period of 6 years. And so when he was in his most desperately insane period of really doing these kind of things to women, this was from 1968 to 1980, 12 years. And I didn't know him then, so I never saw that, you know.
Would there be an occasional moment sometimes once you got to be friends with him where it would suddenly strike you, man, I'm friends with Miles Davis?
What when it generally happened was when somebody would come up to me and say to me, man, what is it like to be with Miles Davis? You know, I always wanted to be with Miles Davis. And then I would think, whoa. But for me, after it got to a certain level, you know, I never thought about it because, you know, we had just had this natural relationship. He'd call me up or I'd call him up. I remember telling somebody one time, Miles called me up from Japan. He had just taped this new thing. And he said, what you think of this? And he put it on. And he played for about 5 minutes and he said, what you think? And I would tell him whether I liked it or I didn't. If I didn't like it, I'd tell him I didn't like it. And I was relating this to somebody and they said, you mean Miles Davis calls you up and puts on the tape and you listen to it? And I said, yeah. He said, well, what's that like? I said, man, I guess it's like any one of my friends who's a poet, you know, who will say, listen to this poem, you know what I mean? Just so happens it's Miles Davis's music, and he happens to be internationally famous.
Many public figures, up close, lose the larger-than-life quality that they seem to have from afar. But there's something about Miles Davis that even today, even though Quincy Troupe was as close to Miles Davis as he's ever been to anybody in his life, that even today, it's easy for Quincy to see Miles as this mythic figure. He says Miles just had this effect on people.
I remember one time it was like I was with him. I can't remember the Japanese, not Miyashi, but it was another Japanese designer. And he had his clothes in New York. And he had his clothes and he had Andy Warhol, before Andy Warhol died, and Miles Davis modeling as the star models of the clothes along with all these beautiful, gorgeous women. So Miles called me and said, you want to go down with me? I said, yeah, I'll go with you. So we go in this place called The Tunnel. It was some kind of a discotheque. So we're in there, and they're modeling the clothes, and everybody's going out. Miles would walk out. Andy Warhol would walk out. So I'm backstage and with Andy, and you know, these are two legends. You know, these are two American icons in culture. So Miles was the finale, and he had this outfit with this gold lamé cape that he was supposed to walk out with a hat. So he started to walk out, and Andy was standing there looking at him, and the cape was dragging on the floor. So he started to walk out, and he turned around and looked at Andy Warhol, and he said to Andy, Andy, pick up that cape. So Andy picked up the tape, and they walked out together, you know what I mean? Like, and Andy had this sheepish look on his face. And Miles strutted out, and Andy was holding the cape off the floor. And they walked up the thing. And so everybody in the room, they left us in the room. Andy's handlers, they were like shocked. They had never heard anything like that. They were like, wow, did you see that? Did you see that? But Andy was smiling. He was like happy to be in it. He was like happy to be in it. And so that was Miles. You know, Miles Davis was like almost like a king. You know what I mean? He was like a king. And so that particular moment, I remember him saying, I remember his attitude was like, I'm the king here. Pick up the cape. You know, we both might be icons, but I'm a bigger icon than you.
Quincy Troupe co-authored Miles Davis's autobiography, Miles. He's a poet and journalist and essayist and author of several books. His latest is called Avalanche from Coffeehouse Press. I'm Ira Glass.